Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday, May 4th. We have three things on the agenda today. First is going to be informational hearing on metropolitan planning organizations. I had talked to Randy Tucker about it with his email, about a 15-minute presentation. Randy's not even here. So for information, people will have different bills. We're going to handle this issue until 10 minutes till 2. The next, I'll give five more minutes than that. We'll finish this at 10 minutes to 2 for 20 minutes, and then we'll get into 2763 and then 2817. So whoever is coordinating the informational hearing, you got the time. You got 20 minutes total, so let's get going.
Thank you very much, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. We're here as a group today representing the various metropolitan plant organizations.
And you are?
My name is Bryce Burkhold. Excuse
Thank
me.
Thank you.
And if I could have the PowerPoint screen, is that on?
Just a second. Push a button.
Okay. And let me just, while we're waiting for that to come up, before you in the packet, there's some information about the slideshow we're going to go through here really quickly. And then there's information on your right-hand side, which are profiles of each of the regions of the state that we prepared here, both to describe what the issues here. There's data, facts, maps, those types of things in there. And then inside on your left-hand side behind the presentation is a list of both the members of all the Metropolitan Planning Organization boards and the members of the board of the Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organization Consortium. And so we're going to run through this here for you really quickly, and because I want to have my colleagues here speak. Metropolitan planning organizations are designated by the federal government of areas that are over 50,000 population, and the governor actually designs the boundaries of those, but these have been around for 30 or so years, and as you see there, there's quite a few local officials that are on the boards of these committees. There are six in the state, and again, you can read, so I'm going to go quickly here. These are the six in the state, ranging from the Portland metropolitan area to Bend and Corvallis, which are everything in between. Our roles, as designated by the federal government, is to develop long-term transportation plans and then identify and fund those regional transportation priorities in addition to being required to comply with air quality rules. Of the state's population, over 2 million live within those six metropolitan plan areas. It's over 60% of the population. And over 800,000 Oregonians outside the metro area live within the Metropolitan Planning Organization boundaries. These are our metropolitan areas. So by their very nature, they're the economic hubs of the state. And most of the state's recent growth has actually been in these areas. And key piece of that functioning of the economy is the transportation. And that's what we do. So what challenges do we face? One is growth. These are last decade's growth numbers. We don't have the most recent ones, but you can see it ranges from 12% Corvallis, which is doesn't include Albany, though. We'll show you the boundaries later, but up to 142% in the Bend area, a 10-year growth rate. So an incredible amount of growth that we have to deal with. And key issue there is how do you stay competitive when you have a lot of growth, declining revenue and finances for building facilities, and you have this major north-south network and then the whole metro area east-west network, both road and rail. And maintaining the functioning of those are really critical. And what we're finding, though, is that we're falling behind the other West Coast states because of our lack of financing for these. Goods movement is a key component. Again, these are our major facilities travel through these metropolitan areas. And if they're congested, freight gets delayed. It reduces reliability, increases expense, and those are key issues that we deal with in our transportation planning. Another issue that's coming on the horizon here is that 34% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the state come from the transportation sector. Clearly, it's going to be take some response, and the metropolitan planning areas will be the areas that we'll have to look at. How do we provide a different mix of transportation, a different means of people moving around so that we can reduce greenhouse gases? Key issue, as you know, and you've dealt with this one a lot, is funding. And coming up with a sustainable funding source that deals with these key issues here is something that we're dedicated to working on and working with you on. The revenue shortfall, you have seen this chart probably before too, compared to other states, including even Montana, Idaho, we are just about two-thirds to half of the funding that they get out of their motor vehicle registration, other taxes, and gas taxes. We had a joint resolution that was passed by everyone, the MPO boards, this last year, that was calling for the state to adopt a $600 million annual increase in our revenue as a way to address these modernization and maintenance needs. And so we encourage you to be ambitious and help us solve our problems and bring the state back. So let's talk about a little bit of the Oregon solution here. And that MPOs, because we do talk about the big picture in our regions, and we look at how the connections happen between land use and transportation, and I'll put a footnote there that Metro, the Portland Metro area, is the only one that actually has land use authority in addition to transportation authority. And it's an issue that's difficult because a lot of the solutions will be how do we design our communities so transportation is not as expensive to provide and we can connect industrial uses and employment, people's homes. I think that's a critical issue. But we also are the place where we talk about balancing our transportation system, looking at buses, transit, light rail, walking, biking, bus rapid transit, all those options there in addition to road investments to ensure that people can move around, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce the cost of transportation to everybody. But what I want to do then, well, actually, we don't. The Ben representative is actually in the House Transportation Committee now speaking, and so I'll hit a couple of these areas. This map here, which you'll find inside those regional profiles, these kind of psychedelic picture here, is actually showing a gradient of travel times from 0 to 45 minutes out from the center of the MPOs. The MPO boundary is a little hard to see. It's that very small blue line around the city of Bend there, and you'll see this blue dashed line around all our MPO boundaries. Yet these numbers are ODOT numbers for number of vehicles on the road, and the size of them is relative to the numbers. So when they get radically small, that's basically where the commuting stops, and it's through traffic then representing that. But the Bend area, this is just an example here, shows that everything from Redmond, Prineville, Sisters are really within the commute shed of Bend, yet the planning regime or the planning organization only touches the city of Bend, and that's a relic of the fact that we have a land use planning system here where we go from urban to rural with an urban growth boundary, and under federal laws, that's when you stop the MPO, and it isn't looking at these commuting issues. Some of their key issues here, again, they're listed for you, but these are very common, is that there are some very specific needs. For example, the multimodal access to the Juniper Ridge industrial area needed, and then the ongoing maintenance and modernization needs. Rogue Valley, they're not done yet. They're also in the other room. We have a representative from there who is our chair of our committee, Mike Quilty, a Central Point City Councilman. Here's the same issue. Grants Pass is not part of the Metropolitan Planning Organization, okay? Yet something like 40% of the workers in Grants Pass go to the Medford, Ashland area for work every day. And so we have an issue here about how do we plan properly for that? And this is some of the issues we've been discussing. They have their issues both looking at short line railroads and whether they can improve freight rail connections to the rest of Oregon and to California, and their ongoing maintenance and modernization needs, as well as the transit system. They're trying to maintain that. And now I do have someone here from Salem Kaiser area to talk about the North Valley greater region, which also includes the Portland metropolitan area. But I'll go to Salem Kaiser first.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr. I'm Kathy Clark. I'm a city councilor from Kaiser. I'm also the vice chair of SCATS, our local MPO, and a member of OMPOC. Today I want to talk a little bit about the Salem-Kaiser area, our MPO. As we have a number of issues that affect us. Our travel shed actually goes all the way up to the Portland metro area because of the fact that we have a lot of commuters between the Portland metro area and the Salem-Kaiser metro area. As you can see from this map, the travel sheds very much overlap and go way beyond the boundaries of our current MPO. Some of the issues that we are facing are the shortfall for regional highway system and I-5. I-5 is our main artery through our metro area and needs to be as functional as possible. Our ability to impact how we plan around that to service I-5 and to get traffic on and off and around I-5 is somewhat constrained because one of our biggest projects that we need to deal with is not in the MPO, and that's the Woodburn Interchange. That one has failed and is desperately in need of being redone so it can function properly, but that is not within the MPO. However, it does impact how we plan. Other things that we're looking at is our transit system. We have a shortfall of $244 million for transit. Developing and maintaining our transit system has been important for making sure that we have good connectivity for many modes as an option for the people who live and work within our metro area. On the flip side, we have a great deal of rural communities that we have within our two-county area, the Marion and Polk County. How we plan for them as well, how to make sure that we have good highways that get them into and through Salem and Kaiser. Freight movement is very, very important to our area. We have a lot of freight that comes through here from our agricultural sector, and we need to have ways to make sure that our trucks can get through as well as rail and other options. Tourism is very important for the Salem-Kaiser area, not only as a through to the coast, but also as a destination. We've seen so many school groups here today that are here to be a part of our local our state government and to enjoy the sights around here. We need connectivity to the coast. The bridge across the Willamette is a huge, huge project that needs to be done. What we have now has already been shown to be inadequate, and we need to have regional funding in order to do that regional-sized project. Finally, safety, connectivity, and having funds to do some of the projects we need for connectivity are going to be very critical to how we plan for our transportation future in the Salem-Kaiser area.
So I'll jump back to the northern side of the North Willamette Valley. And again, we divide it between North and South Willamette Valley because when you look at the travel patterns, that's what really divides the state and in this Willamette Valley. And so we see them as shared issues, and that's one of the reasons we try to work together more on this. Just real quick, some of the issues here. You know many of these are at least covered by the Oregonian issue of I-5 and 205 congestion to the region. And the key thing there is not congestion necessarily just for the region, but also for the state. When you think of 84, I-5, the rail connections, they all converge in the Portland metropolitan area, and congestion there has impacts on whether you're a wheat farmer in Hermiston or you're trying to sell your fruit from Medford. It's key that we maintain that open, yet we have a pretty big shortfall in our 20-year plan here in terms of trying to actually meet that need. We are doing a lot more funding from the local level, and that's a key issue here. And just refer back to what's in the House Bill 2001. There is version of that has amendment that would preempt local fundraising in terms of gas taxes, vehicle registration fees. Yet because of declining state revenues, declining federal revenues, the local share is really important both for matching other funds but also just doing projects. In the metro areas, you see a lot of traffic moves on local roads. They don't not necessarily using the state highway, and we need to have those funds. And so we ask you, and that's part of our position, was to not have preemption of local funds raising as part of the next bill, because we need every pot of money that we can tap onto in that way. And now I'm going to go down to the South Valley Greater Region, which includes representatives both from Eugene, Springfield, and Corvallis MPO.
My name is Andrea Reiner. I am the director of the Central Lane MPO, representing Eugene, Springfield area. And just kind of to tag on, our issues are similar to probably the communities that you've heard today. No big projects. It's really just the dollars to keep the system working. For example, our transit system, as we saw a huge increase in transit ridership over the last year, our revenues actually to that were dropping, so that we were looking at having to cut service at a time when that was the most critical kind of public service we could provide. And our interest is very much in having those local tools available to create a system that's reflective of the kind of diverse interests in our community and that's balanced, as Rex talked about, that we have a transit linked with our roadway system and our bike ped, and that those are well maintained and managed for the best use of those dollars.
Hello, my name is Linda Madrell, and thank you very much, Senator Starr and Senator Metzger, Senators Schrader and George and Verger. Really appreciate your time. Not everybody is as well acquainted with the MPOs as I'm sure you are, but that does bring us to the Corrales area MPO. We have the slowest growth in the state among the MPOs, and I don't know if that's something to brag about or not. But at any rate, that is the case. In our area, we have several issues, and one has to do with Willamette River crossing. And in terms of least cost kinds of planning, we're looking at other solutions besides actually building another bridge. We can't put it off forever, but we are looking at trying to put it off as long as we can. And, of course, we have a variety of what we call short-term needs, but that has to do with being our planning being constrained by funding horizons that don't allow you to do much in the way of creativity. But I guess our bottom line here is that we want to be part of the solution. We really would like to see you all be as aggressive as possible with funding. It's important to us. We do have a list of legislative solutions that may be outdated by now. But I just want to wrap up here with some of the things that we want you to be sure and have as takeaway messages. We're pretty interested in best practices, and that has to do with looking at the roles and the responsibilities of the MPOs. What's the best way to actually deliver transportation to the people across Oregon? And the MPOs aren't the only folks that would be involved in that. We are interested in looking at enhanced decision making on a regional level. We're interested in non-motorized trails. In my MPO this past weekend, we had 100 bicyclists turn out to ride from Corvallis to Albany, about a 10-mile stretch, and this was in support of a multi-use path off of the highway, but generally aligning with a railroad connection there. We're really interested in flexibility, both in funding, how it's used and how it's raised. And it was mentioned before that nobody out there in local government is interested in preemption of taxes. We'd like to be able to let the folks in our area decide whether or not they want additional taxes. And so once again, just to be real clear, if you guys could do as much as possible about being aggressive on this funding, we'd really appreciate it. And I don't know if there's any other comments.
Well, I think to in the time, if you have any questions, the panel would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Burkholder, and all of you. I'll open up for questions here and make sure the panel has any questions they have of you. I guess I would ask both Andrea and Kathy. Andrea talked about the Beltline issues as one of your priorities. You talked about the Woodburn Interchange was a key part of that. If we're successful with House Bill 2001, would you have any objections if we provided help for make sure that Beltline and Woodburn got done? I didn't think so, but I just wanted to make sure. We'll do our best to articulate that. Questions from the committee? Senator George.
I want to ask you kind of a philosophical question to begin with. One of the things I see as being the problem is that we are constantly getting pushed to raise revenue, and there's an immense amount of money that already flows into the process. And so I guess the question is, are the organizations working on trying to figure out how we can streamline the process to make it so the burden isn't always just additional revenues, but also talk about being advocates for finding inefficiencies in the system, streamlining those to reduce the costs? Because the way the presentation was just made to us, it seems like, I think, it always seems like you're asking for more money, but we all know that the system's broken as far as building things.
You know, that, I think that that would be a really appropriate topic to take up under looking for best practices. Mm-hmm. It is difficult for us at the local level to try to create efficiencies in a system that we're not in charge of.
Well, I'd like to just respond to that, Chair Metzger and Senator George. A good example of the value of the Metropolitan Planning Organizations is the recent programming of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds. And we had 2 weeks between the passage of the federal legislation and the actual programming of those dollars. And it was, we knew it was coming. We had no idea what until the last day, of course, exactly what it was and what we had to do. But what MPOs do is gather all the local jurisdictions, including the State Department of Transportation, the transit agencies, and then we do a prioritization process that I think all of our jurisdictions worked really quickly. And the metro area, for example, had to produce $38 million of projects among multiple jurisdictions, rank them, figure them out which ones are shovel ready, ready to go, and then got the money out the door, as I said, in 2 weeks. We included $40 million of transit projects in there as well, and then about $40 million more of ODOT dollars that had to be allocated in the Region 1. So that, because we have a process in place, we're actually able to prioritize and fund things based, of course, on the money we have. That list, we always get to the top, you know, 5%, and then you have all the rest that you're hoping to raise money for. But it is a way of streamlining and making things move faster because we do have the history of working together.
One last point. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, what I'd say is when you're doing presentations, it'd be really important to talk about, to the public, especially to the public, to talk about efficiencies in the system and how you're trying to find those. The other issue I have is that, and I've talked about this a lot, is that the idea of our state planning laws have, in essence, created a number of these problems. And let me give you an example. When you look at the Portland metropolitan area, you have all of the housing was put over in Clackamas County and all the jobs put over in Washington County. So you have this huge... You have this huge commute every day that was created by the planning process. In Corvallis, you have you had restrictions of housing, and so people leapfrogged out to Albany, and you have people leapfrogging
to
Albany.
They have restrictions as well.
Right.
Annexation by vote.
Right. But what I'm saying is that what you've done, in essence, what we've done is we've created leapfrog opportunities in this. In my district, there's a little town of Gaston, which is a little small town that's having a 300-unit subdivision put into it because they have room in their urban growth boundary. Yamhill, Carlton are now becoming bedroom communities for the Portland metro area because they have room in their urban growth boundaries, and people are going further out to find affordable housing to get further out. And that's a planning created phenomena and problem. And it seems like to me that with this leapfrogging problem is a huge part of this, that people seem to be saying we got this great planning system but not looking at the ramifications and spillover effects. And I think the same thing could be true for Clark County versus the northern part of our state, where people have jumped across the border and then now they've got to come across these bridges that we're overloading. So I would also throw out the idea that we have some structural planning problems that are creating leapfrogging that's leading to long-term transportation problems.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, one of the things that Kaiser's doing right now is that we have begun periodic review, and two of the sections we are going to be looking at are our overall vision for our community and then our economic opportunity. One of the things that has come up in our discussion is how we can, given the severe constraints of our urban growth boundary, since we share one with the city of Salem, is how to provide local jobs that are family wage jobs, preserve our local agricultural lands, and also serve the additional growth that we are anticipating for our area in the next 10 to 20 years. So the constraints that we have to work in are a little bit cumbersome right now, but we're trying to look at some creative solutions where we can address that. And as you put, try to avoid that leapfrogging that has been created. The vast majority of our people do work in Salem, but we do have a substantial number that work in the Portland metro area. So if we can provide something locally here through our land use process that allows us some flexibility to both provide jobs and preserve agriculture at the same time, we want to get creative and do it.
Mr. Chair, can I go to Senator Berger?
Oh, sure.
That's all right.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I guess the question is for you. I presume that this group will be making a presentation to the Ways and Means Transportation Sub?
I don't know.
Because the bulk of their presentation has to do with funding.
Okay. Well, you have a member of it right here, Senator Starr, so you know, I can talk to him about that. I think what it will do is put all your stuff in the record that you have provided in the packet. I do appreciate you coming today. Needless to say, we are working very, very hard in delivering some improvements to our transportation system, and I believe that, and this committee will be dealing with that one, and I believe it will be one of the most, if not probably the most significant thing that comes out of this session, and so your support of that would be very, very helpful. We're there for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we'll adjourn the informational meeting. Let's get them in. Okay, we're going to go and open a public hearing on House Bill 2763 and start with Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2763 allows contracting agencies to pay up to 10% more than the lowest bidder for agricultural products produced and transported entirely within Oregon. It allows a percentage higher than 10% if the agency finds and explains a good cause in a written determination.
There are people wandering in the door. I wonder if they'd like to testify. Representative Cannon, would you like to testify on this bill? Okay. We'll see. See, now this bill passed 60 to nothing, so keep that in mind. It can only go down from here.
67.
Welcome.
Good bill.
Thanks. Sure. It's pretty exciting stuff. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Business and Transportation.
That's what it is. Always nice to know who you're talking to.
Strong title. That. Well, this bill came out of the Ag Committee originally. Oh, first of all, Senator, Representative, Brian Clem. Don't tell Peter Clooney that.
Yeah, I was here.
Representative Brian Clem from House District 21 here in Salem. And this bill came out of the Ag Committee, but there's a constituent, well, actually, the food that part of their orchards in my district, I think their house is over on the other side of the street, which is outside my district, but you'll hear from them, and they can talk about their experience trying to work with the Department of Corrections over the years in food purchasing. And at one time, they had a pretty good situation where they were able to sell some fruit to state agencies, and at some point, the bid rules changed, and it became a situation where you could only bid, if you could bid the entire state prison system, all fruits and vegetables on the menu. It kind of knocked out the little guy from being able to sell to the institutions. And then there's some other stories that Representative Cannon can share, but bottom line is we'd like to see the ability, it's a may in the bill, for contracting agencies to give a preference to Oregon-grown agricultural products. And then there's some sideboards that says if it goes over a certain percent, they need to make a written determination on why it costs more, so there's a paper trail, so somebody isn't, you know, giving a contract to their Uncle Louie and trying to hide it within the local food preference provisions. And we didn't have any opposition in committee or on the floor, but interested to see if you find any over here as well, or either.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad you're hearing the bill. I'm Representative Ben Cannon from House District 46 in Portland. This is a great win-win for urban and rural Oregon. The bill came to my attention when my county, Multnomah County, said, look, we would love to be able to purchase local agriculture, even if it costs a little bit more than the faraway food stuff. So a box of pears that may be a penny more if you're buying from Hood River versus buying from New Zealand, we'd like to buy the Hood River pears. I think you'll hear from the county. They'll explain their rationale, but I think it's great in terms of supporting local agriculture, getting healthy, fresh food stuffs into our schools and jails and hospitals, and you know we're certainly hopeful that you'll look upon it favorably. I just echo Representative Clem's comments. Didn't find any opposition. Hope we don't over here. There is. I mean, I think I asked, why were these laws ever on the books in the first place? Why would a agency be ever be prohibited from purchasing locally? And I think the answer probably has something to do with concerns about, you know, the corrupt bureaucrat who's purchasing from their brother who lives down the street and may have the more expensive product, but they're purchasing it anyway. I think we should be sensitive to those concerns. The bill, as it's amended, says you can't pay more than 10% of that lowest bid price, so we've tried to build in at least that safeguard, encourage you to explore that issue and arrive, I think, at the same conclusion that, that we did, that there are adequate safeguards here and in other aspects of contracting law to ensure that we won't be hit with those sort of episodes of corruption. So appreciate the consideration and look forward to a good result.
Thank you. Questions for the representatives? Senator Schrader.
I think actually more of a comment than a question. I want to thank you for this bill. I think it's an excellent bill. And in my previous life as commissioner, I had an opportunity in our county to work on what we called food shed issues, not just with the public entities, but with some of our private institutions. Kaiser, for instance, is a big leader in fresh, wholesome foods. You know, we have a Whole Foods presence in our, you know, in our neck of the woods, too, that commits to buying from local growers. And it became very important as we worked with our Clackamas County Soil, Water, and Conservation District folks, our extension folks, to find opportunities for the local farmers to have, you know, an outlet for their products. And when we move to these kinds of things where we institutionally commit to purchasing local, you can also allow your growers to organize in a way where they get a consistent pipeline of wholesome fresh foods. And so not only will the institutions benefit, it will provide a market for the growers and enable them to coordinate who, what they grow, when they grow it, how they grow it, to make sure that there's consistency in the food pipeline. So I think this is one of the best bills I've seen in this session, and thank you for bringing this forward, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the two representatives? Senator George.
Thank you, gentlemen. I actually had a bill similar to this last session, and I was you guys expanded it, and I really appreciate it. I was doing it basically for schools. I got two quick questions, though, because the issues that I ran into when I had this. One was, is that how will the, when this 5% trigger is triggered, will the taxpayers or the citizens know when we opted for a higher contract? That's question one. And then the second thing is that we're talking about value-added products like French fries or something that you could get from Eastern Oregon. If the salt is brought in from out of state, how do we identify what's produced totally inside the state of Oregon, and how would you envision that working? So those two questions would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, George. The provision, it's up to 10%, actually, at the request of Representative Krieger in particular. Then there's some language around a written determination or finding must be made by the director of the contracting agency. So that document would need to be made available to anybody who wanted to sort of see what the reasons were, because it's not just say you did it. It's you actually have, you have to produce the reasons why. And then the other issue, we chose not to try and define Oregon-grown or Oregon-raised, I forget the words, but further here and let each contracting agency have their parameters. We almost got into this issue about, okay, what if you have the Hood River apple, but then they took it over to Bingen, and then it came back in for a little while, and we decided, you know, each contracting agency, whether it's Multnomah County or prisons, let's let them have that framework, but keep Department of Ag from having to spend a bunch of money doing rulemaking over something where, you know, we felt that there'd be a pretty good paper trail on that issue if people had problems with it in the future.
Any others for our two representatives? Okay, thank you. Mr. Cleave? And did you have someone you wanted to bring up?
Yes, Chair. Mr. Zielinski.
Okay, Mr. Zielinski.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. We are in support of the bill. Unfortunately, as we grow on in session, I have a conflict and I can't stay long. I think some of the questions that were asked by the committee with the earlier panels were great questions. Those were questions that were brought up on the House side, too. And the Farm Bureau supported the bill in its kind of narrow scope because we felt this was a good opportunity to step in the right direction and also put some confines around demonstrating to the legislature that these types of programs have some value-added components to it and keep our food locally. So with that, I'll turn the mic over.
Sure. Welcome.
Hello. I'm Kevin Zielinski, and I'm Vice President of Easy Orchards Incorporated. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. We grow, pack, and ship apples, peaches, and pears, and have for many years in the local area and up and down the West Coast. I believe it would be prudent to support House Bill 2763, a deliberate effort to enhance the sale of Oregon food products to public institutions is rational and will benefit the people who work in the agricultural community in Oregon. I think this is going to be a win-win situation for the employees of the corporations and small farmers and for the farmers themselves. I encourage passage of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Zielinski. Questions for either Mr. Cleve or Mr. Zielinski? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
We have one other person to testify, Kat Nest. Nest? Excuse me.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger and committee members. My name is Kat West, and I am the Sustainability Manager for Multnomah County. And first, let me start by thanking the sponsors of House Bill 2763 and thanking the committee for the opportunity to be here today to speak in support of the bill. I am here because Multnomah County wants to support Oregon farmers, and current state law prevents us from doing that. And I'm here today because Multnomah County knows that our dollar choices shape the very community that we live in. And we believe it's important to invest in our family farms, our food security, our local economy, and in local jobs. Current law, as Representative Cannon mentioned, current law says that Multnomah County cannot prefer Oregon-grown food if that Oregon-grown food costs not $100 more, not a dollar more, but one penny more than, say, apples from New Zealand or grapes from Chile. And we believe that we should be able and we should have the authority to support Oregon farmers. Multnomah County spends over $2 million a year feeding the inmates in our jails, and we want to spend and we want to keep that money in Oregon. We want to spend that money supporting our local farmers and supporting the local economy and growing local jobs. And it's not just the Multnomah County elected officials, but our taxpayers want us to spend and keep that money in Oregon as well. Multnomah County residents recently identified a strong local food system as one of their top community priorities. Multnomah County supports House Bill 2763 because it allows contracting agencies to do the right thing, and that is support Oregon farmers, the local economy, and grow local jobs.
Thank you, Ms. West. Any questions? Senator George.
Thanks. Kat, I want to come back to the question I asked the representatives, which is, as a taxpayer in the bill, in the engrossed bill, allows a farmer to charge 10% more than their competitors, and an agency could even bring it up higher than that. How do we make sure that this doesn't get out of control and it doesn't start to become a huge budget issue?
Mm-hmm.
How would you report this so the taxpayers could actually see with transparency that how much additional this is costing them?
Well, I think Representative Clem mentioned that the bill right now says that if the premium is more than 10%, there has to be a written determination by the contracting agency director, and that would become part of the record. The bill is also written as discretionary. And in the current economic condition that we're in, Multnomah County probably will not be paying 10% more for local food. Hopefully we'll be paying some more because it is a community priority, but we won't. It's discretionary. So in each contract, it's specific to that contract, in each year with the fiscal condition, it will change. At right now, if it's between 0 and 10% premium, I don't believe there is a notification requirement written into the bill.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2763 in committee. If we're okay to go, we'll just open a work session on House Bill 2763.
Mr. Chair, I move the bills to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2763 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So who would like to carry the bill?
I would like to.
Senator Verger. Carry the bill. Thank you. All right. Close the work session. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2817. Mr. Stenbridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2817A authorizes the Oregon Department of Transportation to issue a certificate to operate a for-hire carrier of household goods without prior notice to other certificate holders. It eliminates protest and hearing rights of other certificate holders when application for certification is under consideration. It repeals requirement that persons perform pack and load services registered with ODOT. And it requires background checks of household good moving company employees, creates the offense of offering to transport household goods without a certificate, and it increases the civil penalty for violation from $500 to $1,000.
Okay, I think I'll start with Mr. Russell from the Oregon Trucking Association. We had a number of these bills. We had some on this in our committee, and the House asked they start this bill, so we allowed them to start it over there. We have a number of sponsors of this. Same thing over here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell. I'm today representing the Oregon Moving and Storage Association, which is a conference of the Oregon Trucking Association. And with me today is Tom Jordan, one of the board members of the Oregon Moving and Storage Association, and he's currently working with Eastside Van and Storage. I'm going to start the testimony, and then Tom's going to conclude it. Transportation industries have been regulated both by the federal government and in Oregon for a very, very long time. However, over the last 25 years, we've sort of been on a glide path to eliminate the regulation of transportation industries. One of the exceptions has been the household goods moving industry, which in every transportation deregulation bill is accepted, and the regulation has continued. So what you've ended up with is an island of regulation in a sort of a sea of deregulation in transportation. Household goods is virtually the only thing that continues to be regulated. Back in 2001, we came to the legislature with a bill to change some of the household goods regulation. What we ended up with was a bill that created a task force. In 2003, we came back with the recommendations from that task force, which passed, which were modest modifications of the regulation of household goods movers. In the last year, at least from February of 2008 till February of 2009, the Department of Transportation has aggressively enforced the household goods regulations. They've done a number of sting operations around the state. They've done six, one in Milwaukee, one in Canby, one in Bend, one in Eugene, one in Fairview, and one in Medford. What I just passed out to you is a press release from the one in Medford. And let me tell you what they found in those six enforcement exercises. There were 136 truck or driver safety violations. There were 11 trucks were placed out of service. There were seven that were driving while suspended. 10 trucks were impounded. Six were driving uninsured. Seven were arrested for warrants or parole violations. So what we have is a significant problem with the folks that are transporting household goods essentially illegally today. So we're here with a bill that we think will change the system significantly and will make the regulation more effective in terms of consumer protection. So let me tell you what the bill does. Today, the existing movers can go to ODOT and protest someone that wants to get into that business. If they protest, then ODOT has to conduct a hearing. There is a very strict legal hurdle that the new person has to overcome in order to become a mover. Quite frankly, it seldom happens. So the first thing that this bill would do is it would eliminate that ability of the existing household goods movers to protest new entrants into the field. If somebody wanted to become a mover, they would apply to ODOT. ODOT would determine if they're fit to do the that kind of business. If ODOT made that determination, they would issue them the license, and they're in the business. Now, the intent of this is to get everybody under ODOT regulation so that we can, in fact, effectively do the consumer regulation to protect consumers out there. The other things that it does is it clarifies the definition of household goods movers. It eliminates the existing regulation of pack and loaders, which over time the definition between household goods movers and pack and loaders got blurred to the extent that you couldn't tell one from the other, and that created part of the problem with the illegal moving. By eliminating the regulation of pack and loaders and clarifying what they can do, then it represents a bright line between household goods movers and people that are essentially providing labor to help someone move in their own truck or a U-Haul truck or something like that. It makes that distinction very clear. It also provides for criminal background checks for people that are actually entering homes, which we think, based on what we've discovered with the sting operations that ODOT has done over the last year, is a very good thing. It also increases the penalties from $500 to $1,000 for violation of the regulations. I think all of these things together will allow ODOT to do a better job in regulating household goods movers to protect consumers. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Tom and let him give you a little bit of background from someone that's actually in the business.
Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and the rest of the committee. My name is Tom Jordan. I'm a director at Eastside Van and Storage, and I'm a member of the Oregon Moving and Storage Association. I'm on the board of directors there. Eastside Van and Storage has been in business since 1955. We have 25 employees on the trucks and an additional 10 to 15 seasonal employees during the summer, which is the peak season for our business. Eastside and the other members of the Oregon Moving and Storage Association have been concerned about the number of companies providing the household goods moving business services to the general public, mainly because when it's mishandled and misled, the consumer's misled, it provides a smearing type effect on the whole business, not just one moving company or one individual. We are a heavily regulated industry, and as Bob had told you, we've been heavily regulated since the 30s. And when somebody operates outside of the regulatory environment, flying by night and not complying with certain rules and regulations that are not only taxable, you know, state and highway federal taxes, workers' compensation taxes, but also, you know, consumer protection, it can damage the reputation of the business, like I said. One reason we believe that there's a proliferation of illegal operators entering to the Oregon market is because of the investigations that he had talked about, but our estimators see them on a daily basis and are not able to lower their standards to meet the costings and the misconstruing information that's given to the customer. We believe that by removing the barriers for them to come into the business, that they'll be operating on the same playing field that we're operating on, having to provide the workers' compensation and paying the highway taxes and all the other incidentals that come to be a normal day-to-day operating procedure for a moving company. We, for this reason, support this House Bill 2817.
I'd like to say that this bill came out of the House Transportation Committee with a unanimous vote. It came off the House floor 60-0, and I urge your support, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. I do have my first question would be, could you explain to me the elimination of the insurance requirement of why that is the case for the pack and loaders?
The pack and load definition became very confused. 25 years ago, it basically what it was that allowed somebody to provide labor to somebody to help a homeowner pack their goods and load it usually into a U-Haul vehicle, and the homeowner drove it to destination, and it was just providing labor. So there was no insurance really required at that point. Someone was just hiring laborers to give them a hand. That definition changed based on an attorney general's opinion that said that the pack and loader could in fact drive the vehicle from the origin home to the destination home. However, they couldn't drive the vehicle from the rental agency to the origin or from the destination back to the rental agency. Well, that created a lot of confusion, and in fact, pack and loaders were picking up the vehicle from the rental agency, driving it to origin, and doing basically acting like a mover. When we did the reforms in 2003, we left the definition of pack and loader the same, but we required them to be regulated because, in fact, they were providing the same service as the regulated mover. So the legislature passed the requirement that they have insurance just like a regulated mover. What we've done in this bill is we've clarified what the pack and loaders can do. They're going back to the old days when they would just provide labor to help the homeowner. So no longer are they providing a transportation service, so we no longer need the insurance requirement, and that's why that requirement's going away.
Okay, so just kind of that differentiation between the four hire carriers and the pack and loaders.
Precisely.
Okay. Questions for the panel? Senator Berger.
I don't have a question, but I just have a comment, Mr. Chair. We thought in 2003 we were straightening it out and fixing it, but apparently we didn't fix it. So now we're back, and so we've gone back to what we had before, which is a little bit confusing as to how that has occurred.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, this is very different. We are essentially opening up the doors to the tent, and we're saying, let's get everybody in the tent. Where in 2003, we left the old regulations in place that basically excluded people from getting into the business and becoming legitimate movers. So that's a very different approach this time versus what we took in 2003.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Adam Sweet, Don Colvin, and Steve Buckstein. Can go first.
My name is Adam Sweet. I'm the owner of Two Brothers Moving and Delivery that's located in Portland, Oregon. I spoke at the last hearing as well for the House that was proposing this bill. I made some comments that I think that it looks like that they addressed. First of all, I just wanted to comment also, maybe this would clarify some information for you. With the current regulations as they are, the moving companies, what tends to happen is you tend to have three layers of moving companies that occur within the industry. The top layer would be the licensed moving companies that are licensed by ODOT and follow tariffs, and then the second layer would be moving companies who have insurance, who pay workers' compensation, and do everything that would be required of them normally, but are not allowed a license because of the veto provision. And then the third tier would be our fly-by-night movers. So I think what this bill is trying to address is trying to let the middle tier come in that would normally qualify to have a license, but isn't currently allowed to because of the monopoly rule that we have in place right now. My business would be included in that category. The two concerns that I primarily had with the bill as it is right now, and I don't know if they're major or not because I'm not a political science major by any means, but the concern that I had was the wording that was used in terms of public interest. Previously, it was public need, and the definition of public need, as ODOT had made determined over years of administrative hearings, was that public need was not population growth, it was not offering a better service, it was not offering a cheaper service. It was simply if the other moving companies did not have enough trucks or did not answer their phone, every single one of them, then you would not be allowed in the industry. Public need could have been defined differently, and when it was defined in law previously, they did not say that. They did not say public need is not this and this. The administrative law judges determined that based on what the law said. And so I'm worried that public interest over time could turn into something else, and that would be a concern to me. In fact, I would also advocate that public interest or public need are not used in any industries that are related to us if you want to get a contractor's license, for instance, and I think Sam would be able to talk more about that. There isn't any need to show public interest. In fact, my own interest is enough for me to go get a public, to go get a utility or whatever, a contractor's license. The second thing that I would say, too, is that it does say that ODOT may give the carrier the license if they're under compliance. I'm not sure if that just means that they're in a good mood that day or if they must give it. I'm not sure if that even matters or not. I know it's just a word, but when I read a lot of the laws that say that they must give the license, and that makes me kind of doubt. Maybe they may, maybe they might not. But yeah, the primary thing that was definitely the public interest, and I would strongly encourage you guys to just reconsider that and maybe see the future consequences that could have. Otherwise, I really am obviously in support of this going forward, and I'm very excited to be able to go apply at ODOT, and I know all the guys at ODOT, I'm sure they'll be happy to have me finally as a registered mover, so I'm really happy this is here.
Thank you, Mr. C. Well, I'll ask ODOT about your question in a little bit. Mr. Colvin.
Hi, thanks for allowing me to speak today, Chair Metzger and the committee. My name is Don Colvin. I'm married, I have three kids. I started all around movers in 99, and I've been a mover for most of my life. It's the only job that I have an aptitude for that's also going to enable me to support my family and may allow me to send my kids to college. And I'm grateful the state's looking to change the unfair legislation that currently exists. Removing the veto option is a great start. I'm concerned, just like Mr. Sweet, that the new bill is vague and should be clarified, some parts of it, in particular a part about the proposed service being in public interest. And I don't think it should be the applicant's burden to prove it's in the public interest if this is the case. This is one of the main problems of the old legislation. I think authority should be granted unless it's against the public interest, and if denied, show support in real terms as to why. If an applicant has the skill, knowledge, and is physically able to do the work, is willing to obtain all the necessary insurances and use a safe vehicle, that business should be allowed the same opportunity that every American has a right to, as is written in our Constitution. If I can perform better than my competition or offer a more competitive price, it should be the consumer's choice whether to hire my company. And I believe that competition is healthy for the economy. That's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. Steve.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and a founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest research group. Our mission is involved in what we're doing here today to promote individual liberty, personal responsibility, and economic opportunity in Oregon. And I think this issue touches on all three of those. You heard earlier, and I'm sure you read in the paper and saw in the news about the stings of quote-unquote illegal movers around the state. And I think when that happened, it was really time, and I'm glad you are, starting to look not just at the quote-unquote illegal movers and what the industry, but at the regulations that maybe cause some of these people to be quote-unquote illegal. When legitimate companies can't get a license for moving household goods because their competitors are in effect offered a veto of their license application, it's time to not just look at, but to change the laws, because those are unfair practices. I like the fact that House Bill 2817 would eliminate this requirement so that you wouldn't have to notify, ODOT wouldn't have to notify the competitors, and the competitors wouldn't have a veto as such. That that's clearly a step in the right direction. But as the two gentlemen here who know a lot more about this than I do have stated, the language of the bill, as I read it, also says that ODOT then may grant the license to a mover if it's in the public interest. And again, as Mr. Sweet said, the public interest, I think, is really up to the mover and the consumer, primarily the consumer, not ODOT. I don't think any government agency really can second guess what's in the public interest. I know we worked quite a bit several years ago in Portland when there was a virtual monopoly of the taxi cab industry, and there it was even stricter. You had to prove that there was a need for one more cab in the market, which is impossible. You put one on the street and you're illegal by definition. This isn't quite that bad, but again, there's been no licenses granted, as I understand it, for at least a few years. And again, I think that clearly, it should be up to the individual, up to the consumer, to decide what company they choose, what price they're willing to pay, as long as everything is disclosed, as long as everything is above board. And so what I would suggest to clarify this in this measure is, again, change the word may grant if it's in the public interest to shall grant unless there's some clearly defined health or safety reason not to. That gets away from the amorphous term of public interest. Clearly, if there's not insurance, if there's a safety factor is within the stings, if they're unsafe trucks or whatever, drivers without licenses, those are legitimate reasons not to grant a license. But those can be quantified, I think, where public interest is pretty amorphous. So in closing, I think House Bill 2817 is a step in the right direction, but I fear it's not a big enough step to truly allow freedom of competition among carriers and to allow more freedom of choice for consumers. And I think you have the opportunity now, this committee and the Senate, to both help entrepreneurs like these gentlemen and people who want to earn an honest living in Oregon to get into this business, and you have an opportunity to provide more consumer choice for people who want options in how they move their households. So I thank you for listening, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Beckstein. Just one observation. The word may is consistent in the existing statute for everything else. It's LC does those kind of things. I share your questions about the public interest, and we're going to ask that in a few moments when we have I'm going to ask ODOT to come up and maybe even Mr. Russell back. Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Okay. Samuel, is it Gross? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Samuel Gross. I'm the owner of 24 Hour Moving. Much of my sentiments are the same as with the panel that was recently up here. I'm the same boat as these other owners are as well, too. We enter into a very interesting situation due to the current laws. We are given the authority to pack and load. If you rent the U-Haul truck, we can pack it. We can move your office from any point in the state of Oregon to any other point in Oregon or beyond. We are also under federal authority. I'm able to pack up your house, move it to Washington or any other point in the continental U.S. But what we are not allowed to do with the current statute is we are not allowed to take a chair, put it into our truck, and drive it down the street and unload it. Most of us in this second category that Mr. Sweet described carry full insurance, in fact, in excess of what's required by the state of laws due to commercial contracts that we carry. Currently, my company, we are required to carry background checks on all our employees due to contracts we have with national big box retailers and delivery work we do for those companies. I don't think we're here to advocate deregulation of the industry and its in totality, but to open up the market to a fair competition so that we all may enter and participate in this industry. Mr. Sweet mentioned that I also hold a contractor's license in the state of Oregon here. For the past several years, I've been building what for most of us is our number one investment, your home. To obtain this license, I had to merely take a test that described insurance and legal requirements on what I was obligated to do, and I could begin construction after filing the necessary insurance requirements. I think, to me, it's kind of, you know, I'm allowed to do this activity, but on the other hand, I'm not allowed to move somebody's furniture around the corner, as it seems. I ask you, which is the greater liability in this instance here? I'm in support of the bill here, although I think the clarifications that have been brought up, the language needs to be clarified as to what the actual intent is so that we're not here 5 years later revisiting this issue and that we can get this resolved once and for all. I thank you for your time this afternoon. If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Any questions for Mr. Gross? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Russell, would you come back up for, and Mr. Del Ponte, would you please come forward too? Mr. Russell, I'd like, since I know you were intimately involved in this legislation, on page 5, line 19, that was brought up, that the proposed service is in the public interest. Could you give me some background as to why that language is in there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. We're talking about terms of art and transportation regulation. The public interest standard has been around for a long time as the public convenience and necessity standard. What we have today with regard to household goods movers is the public convenience and necessity standard. The fellow from the Cascade Policy Institute, when he talked about taxi cabs, what you have to prove is that there's room for one more taxi cab before you can put one on the street. That's basically what the public convenience and necessity standard is. But you take it one step further, the people that are in the business have the ability to say to someone that wants to get in the business, they protest, which makes that new person prove that there is the need for one more taxi cab, or in our case, one more household goods mover, which is the very difficult hurdle to overcome, and that's why there haven't been any new household goods movers, ostensibly for a long time. So what we're doing is eliminating the public convenience and necessity standard, and we're going to what is known to us in transportation as the public interest standard. And that basically means that the applicant is fit, willing, and able to do that, and you'll find those exact words in subparagraph A, starting on line 25, which is sort of like the description of when you apply for a contractor's license, that you have to take a test. In this case, you don't have to take a test, but you have to demonstrate that you have the ability to do that. You have to demonstrate that the vehicles are going to be operated safely. That's paragraph B. And these are all listed underneath public interest. Mm-hmm. So you've got the standards pretty well laid out here. And those are defined terms in the case law, just like public convenience and necessity was a defined term in the case law. So I think what we intended, and I think what we've done here, is we've effectively eliminated any barriers to somebody getting into the business other than they have to demonstrate that they can conduct the business in a reasonable fashion to protect the consumer. And that's safety, that's insurance, that's those kinds of things. And those are all listed right here. So that's probably a longer explanation than you wanted, but that's...
No, that was helpful. Mr. Del Ponte, would you identify yourself for the record? And before I go to questions, I'd like to... you've heard the concern, you've heard the testimony, you've heard Mr. Russell give his interpretation, and I would like, after you identify yourself, to give your interpretation of how the department views that language. Welcome, and thanks for your written testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Greg Del Ponte. I'm the administrator for ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Given the experience that the gentlemen that have testified have experienced, the reservations are certainly not unreasonable. I understand the nature of their question. I would like to clarify for the record that the current content of House Bill 2817 is consistent with policy guidance that the department has offered in 2001 and in 2003. We have, for a long time, advocated a relaxation of entry standards for the simple purpose of allowing folks that are ready, willing, and able to safely participate in the business to come under our regulatory authority as a legitimate motor carrier. the kernel of the problem that exists in this industry is all wrapped up in what has been called the public convenience and necessity requirement. And if the chair would allow, let me give you a two-minute explanation of what that's all about and how this solves the problem, I believe, to their satisfaction.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Public convenience and necessity is actually a current requirement of law. It's in Chapter 825, and it basically asks the question, is a service proposed by the new applicant required by the present and the future public convenience and necessity? This law has been in place for decades. It's been subject to various interpretation by administrative law judges, through administrative hearings, and it's also been interpreted by the courts. And so the test that we apply whenever we receive an application that is contested by someone that already holds authority for the marketplace in which the new authority is requested is a three-part test. Is the proposed service responsive to a public need? Will the proposed service better serve that need than would the service provided by existing carriers? And if affirmative findings are made on the first two factors, will any diversion of traffic from the protestants impair transportation services provided to the public? So you can see that the intent here is to make certain that the theory behind economic regulation of entry is you want to make certain that there is an adequate level of service available to the public, but not so much that through competitive forces, motor carriers are not able to remain in business so that the household goods moving service is not available to the public. That hasn't worked well in practice. It's further defined by the court. Administrative law judges are guided by a 1963 decision, Aero Transportation versus Hill. They defined public convenience and necessity. And the court in that case ruled that a policy of regulated monopoly favors existing carriers. And what that means is that existing carriers have the right to serve expanding needs if they can do so adequately, and that an applicant must show that the existing carriers are either unwilling or unable to meet the additional need that they propose to meet. So it's not an arbitrary standard. It's been defined in statute and administrative hearings. As you've heard in testimony, it hasn't worked out well in practice, and it has created this current difficulty. And so my understanding of the language in House Bill 2817 is that the applicant simply must be fit, willing, and able, and use safe vehicles. The statute as written prescribes that the department may by rule further define what fitness amounts to. And while that work has not yet been done, because the bill has not been signed into law, I would suggest to you that in a collaborative rulemaking, we will define a reasonable facsimile of what does fit mean. It may include such things as the applicants are compliant with Oregon income tax requirements. The applicants are compliant with workers' compensation insurance requirements. It will likely include a financial component, that they are insurable, that they are adequately capitalized and can operate a business successfully. It may look at whether or not there's a history of bankruptcy in X number of recent years. On an ongoing basis, the fitness requirement will apply to existing household good carriers as well as new applicants. We'll ask if they're complying with the rate tariffs. I imagine it would probably include a pre-operational safety check of the equipment so that we no longer have occasions, as Mr. Russell described, of our enforcement exercises where a significant number of the trucks being used are being placed out of service because they're not safe. But if the applicant is safe, if the applicant is willing and the applicant is fit, I cannot imagine that the language that legislative counsel has used to craft the bill would provide any kind of a bar, and the department would issue the authority to the applicant.
Thank you for that explanation on the record, Mr. Delpani. Questions for either gentleman? Senator George.
Chairman, maybe I misunderstood, but it seems like to me that the whole question that concern is comes down to page 5, line 19, starting with the fourth word in. It says the proposed service is in the public interest. And Mr. Russell, you implied that the public interest were the items listed in 4A, B, on down through F. But in that line it says, and the applicant meets the requirements of subsection 4A, B, D to F of this section. And I think the concern is that that's an additional requirement that ODOT will come up with some definition of the public interest. So the way I read this is that the applicant has to meet A through F, but then also has to meet this ambiguous definition of what's in the public interest. And I don't think that that's where we want to go to. It seems like to me that we just need to delete those seven words right there. The proposed service is in the public interest. I don't understand why it's there or how it adds to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that term also is defined by legal precedent and court opinions and all of those kinds of things. And it's the things that Mr. Dilipani described, which is slightly more than what you have here. And it is, he talked about compliance with income tax. That's specifically not in here. Compliance with workers' comp, that's specifically not in here. Insurance, liability insurance is in here. And that starts on line 35 under F. So the department needs some latitude, I think. But like I say, the big hurdle here has always been that the folks that are in the business can protest the ones that want to get in, and then that causes this public convenience and necessity standard to kick in. That's gone with this bill. And I guess the question then becomes, how prescriptive do you want to be in setting up the standards for somebody to get into the business? And how much do you want to delegate to the department, which, as Mr. Dilipani said, would be any refinement of this would be carried out in a rulemaking, administrative rulemaking?
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yeah.
When I go in for a food processing application, the Department of Agriculture doesn't ask me if I comply with BOLI or if I comply with the Department of Revenue. And that's not the questions that the Department of Agriculture asks me. We have BOLI, we have the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we have the Department of Revenue to regulate my business in those other areas like workers' comp insurance or those things. And it seems like to me that if that's what you're talking about, I'm trying to figure out, then in essence, are we asking the Department of Transportation then to regulate Bureau and Labor Industries issues, or we're going to ask them to regulate Department of Revenue issues? And I'm not sure that that's a step that I'd want to take. And if this is controversial language and all we're talking about is duplicating regulations, I'd feel way more comfortable if that particular line was struck from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I do not think we're disagreeing. Let me address the two questions you asked in that. With regard to what should we appropriately look at to define is an applicant fit? Again, we have not written the rule. I offered you some suggestions of what it might include. And in doing so, I didn't conjure it up. We looked to the north. We looked at other states that had household goods entry statutes that we thought were closer to what we'd been recommending since 2001. In this particular language, we're taking advantage of some of the work that has been done and is in place in the state of Washington. That's how it's done in Washington to the north. It seemed reasonable as a manner of determining if they're fit. The bill asks us to define what is fit, and so what kind of things go into that definition, it will be defined through a rulemaking, which will have an opportunity for public input. And with regard to the intention behind the insertion of the language in the public interest, I think I would agree with the chair who suggested that I don't believe that there was any intent on the part of the crafters. Certainly is no intent on the part of the department. I believe that is a term of art that exists in current law. It was carried forward by legislative council, and I'm entirely comfortable with the line of reasoning and the conclusion you reach, but I think the language as such gets to where you want it to be with the clarification I've offered.
Questions?
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your work on that. Obviously, this has been an interest, Senator George, I've had, Senator Starr, I think just about everybody on the committee has. I'm comfortable with the history behind the definition, and I know the whole or a primary issue was others having an opportunity to veto someone to be in the business. I understand the fitness standard has to be refined, and it is important because if someone takes your goods, you want to make sure you're going to get them back. That is important. And my understanding is, from what you said, Mr. Dalpani, as you do rulemaking on that standard, it would apply to all, not just the new people into. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So not only issuing, but the extension or transferring, so everyone has to meet that standard.
On an ongoing basis.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2817. And, committee, I'm comfortable moving forward with this if you are, so I'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2817A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
It comes back to this whole issue on page 5, and I just really don't. We don't put things in law that don't have any meaning, and I'm still struck by this line 19. And I understand that the last panel basically told me that this doesn't conflict, but it says the proposed service is in the public interest, and that implies that it's an additional criteria that's above this other stuff. Now, I thought it was clear on the record that they were saying it's not an additional criteria. I think it'd be a lot more clear. And what I'm afraid of is that we're going to be dealing with this next session because they say, oh, something else is in the public interest. And I, if what we're trying to say is that the applicant meets this criteria and we're giving the agency the ability to define the terms fit and willing and able, so we're giving them a lot of latitude. I'm really nervous about this additional line in line 19 that seems out of place and has raised the concerns of people testifying. So I'm just simply saying, I don't know if we can, since it's not going to have any fiscal impact, I doubt we can do conceptual amendments, but it seems like to me that striking that line would make a lot of sense. Otherwise, I think we're going to be back here at some point in the future dealing with it.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Senator George. I'm also moved by the consistency of all of our motor carrier laws, which use that language, and now we have eliminated the two issues that are really critical. I'm also comfortable by the fact that the rulemaking is going to apply to everybody. It's not going to just be for new entrants. And thirdly, I'm comfortable by this bill takes effect. Our gentlemen and others will be here, and if they have any barriers, we're going to hear about it right away. And I appreciate Mr. Dalpani's comment on the record that they intend to issue, if they meet all the fitness standards, those certificates, which is our goal. And I'm comfortable with the word of the department on that, and we will certainly know if that was not the case, in which case we would visit it very, very quickly. But I feel comfortable with that. Senator Berger.
Mr. Chairman, the thing that concerns me is the people in the industry don't seem comfortable, and that bothers me. In other words, that there's a possibility that I could be fit and pass all of that, but then the department says, but you know, it's really not in the public interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that when you talk about rules and rulemaking, that opens another whole can of lack of trust. And so I think it can be worked out. I think it's really just a little bit that would really improve it and give the people in the industry comfort. And I just I can't support the bill with the level of discomfort. And I don't think it's great. I think it's small. So I think we could get there very easily. So.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee about that? Okay. Schrader, Senator Schrader, how do you feel about that?
I'm fine.
Senator George?
Well, you know my preference. I'm not going to vote no on the bill because I think the bill has an overriding good effect, but I just do think it would be clear if we took the time to get an amendment. But.
Well, let me, Mr. Dalpani, I hate to bring you up again, but I'm going to ask you for just one more second. We're in the work session, and I'm going to have another committee coming here in a second. The world does not end today, but I will while you're here.
That's right. We changed voice.
Yeah.
I know the history that you've given us and that it is in the motor carrier law. I'm very familiar with that. Could you give me your evaluation? If those words in this particular part of the motor carrier law were deleted totally, what impact, if any, would that have, do you believe?
Mr. Chairman, it's not an ODOT bill.
And I understand that.
In my opinion, I will not enforce the resulting law in any different way if the language remains or if the language is struck.
Okay. So we'll close the work session, House Bill 2817A, and we're adjourned.